We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
You got Matt Miller on all the time.
Matt Miller.
Here I come. You ready?
Lead NFL and NFL draft analyst at Bleacher Report.
The NFL, you need guys who have upside and potential, and yet that's something that kind of makes you special.
The Stick to Football Podcast.
We ain't got to talk about too much. We're just having fun and we're working, baby. That's it.
Going through college and NFL film.
You need to be just an MF-er out there where you're going to put this guy on the ground every play.
Matt Miller with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Matt Miller at NFL Draft Scout on Twitter. Bleacher Report, Stick to Football Podcast, brought to you by Webb Ford. Searching for a great deal on Fords in Chicago? Visit Webb Ford in Highland, Indiana. Matt, it was in this very segment that we were talking about my Heisman Trophy vote, and you just sort of put it out there to voters and say, look, write Tua Tagovailoa's name in there and don't worry about it and be done with it. You know, I'm glad I didn't take your advice so I could see that last day. But also, I agonized over it, and I, you know, I can't reveal who it was until after the award is announced based on the rules of the balloting. But I agonized over it because there is no wrong answer, I think, between the top two contenders.
Yeah, I think that it's tough, right? And some of the things that I've talked to other voters about is that how do you take one game of Tua's where he was hurt? And I think that's the key is do you punish a guy for getting hurt and trying to play through it? Or do you look at it and say, oh, well, you know, gutty performance, it's an SEC championship game. He went out there not at 100% and tried to give it a go and couldn't. Or do you say, on a day where he was below average, Dwayne Haskins was fantastic, Kyler Murray was once again fantastic. And I think this is like, there's not a wrong answer this year. There's really not. I still feel like I said on the podcast this week, my vote would go to Tua. I think he is the most outstanding college football player in the country this year. And sometimes that doesn't mean he has the best stats. Sometimes it doesn't mean, you know, you're not going to have a rough game out there. I think you can look at Kyler Murray had the first go around against Texas or the game against Army where his numbers weren't as good. But it's one of those years where, like, you really don't want to, like, crap all over one kid to make another look good. Like, they're both fantastic football players, and they're both very exciting. And I know I actually talked to one voter, on Saturday. I was like, you know, Kyler Murray's done after this year playing college football. He's going to go play baseball for the A's. Tua has next year. And so let's just give Kyler the award this year. Tua's going to have another shot at it. Murray isn't. And he felt like that was one of the deciding factors for him was that this is a one-and-done type guy. So let's give him this award while we can.
That seems really weird to me, but I guess if that's the way they want to do it, I suppose they can. I feel like Kyler has $4.5 million coming to him from the A's. What the hell does he need a Heisman Trophy for? Just as a scouting exercise, Matt, Tua remains, I would imagine, the top pro-ready. I know he's not eligible, but your top pro quarterback. How would Kyler Murray equate to an NFL quarterback job from your eye?
It's really tough because he's incredibly efficient. He's an explosive dual threat. I mean, he's so incredibly quick and instinctive, but the hard thing is that he's so small. I mean, he's so incredibly small. And I know that we've moved past that a little bit. You know, you can look at Baker Mayfield, who's, you know, 6 foot tall, but Baker Mayfield's like 220 pounds. Kyler Murray's probably like 180. So there's a major difference there. It's not just that he's short, but he's actually a very small player. And I think we're going to see that Saturday night when he stands next to Dwayne Haskins and Tua on the stage. You're going to be like, oh my God, like, is this a slot receiver winning the Heisman? No, it's a quarterback. But he is so small that I think there would be concerns there. Again, the Army game, the Oklahoma State game, the first game against Texas, you can look at and say, man, you know, when defenses were able to slow him down as a runner, he really struggled. Lamar Jackson was a late first-round pick as a similar type of player, and he's quite a bit bigger. So I think if you go into it with that as your baseline, then you could probably say Kyler Murray would be, you know, maybe like a late day two pick. But again, so much of a quarterback evaluation starts now. And it's, you know, things like football IQ. What are you asked to do? You know, throwing into tight windows, throwing with anticipation, getting the ball out quickly within the pocket, all the things that made Baker Mayfield a great quarterback in that system. Mm-hmm. It would be trying to figure out if Kyler Murray is that same guy, or, you know, if it was a little bit of the system that allowed him to have such a great year. Because I'll tell you, I have to eat some crow about this. I did not expect him to be good. Not even, I didn't expect him to be this good. I didn't expect him to be good, because what we saw at Texas A&M was so bad from Kyler Murray. And then he shows up at Oklahoma and has a Heisman-type year. It's really pretty fascinating.
Watching Tua, it's weird to see a lefty quarterback for those of us that watch the NFL. I don't know when we realized this, but there are no left-handed quarterbacks in the NFL. There's no Mike Vick. There's no Mark Brunell. Just not there. Is that just happenstance, or is there a scouting reason for it?
I don't think there's a scouting reason. It's just kind of weird, right? My buddy Chris Sims is a lefty, and you know, it's like once a couple of those guys got out of the league, it's just not something you see very more. And I've been asked this question quite a bit this year. I don't think there's any like real reason for it. You know, it's not that, oh, well, defenses are, you know, predominantly right-handed, so you get all the pressure coming off the right side of the defense, which goes right into the face of a left-handed quarterback. Like it's not really like that. It's just that for whatever reason, and I honestly don't know what percentage of the population is left-handed. Maybe it's just that, you know, there's X amount of people who are left-handed. And then when you narrow that down and look at, I mean, how many of us right-handed idiots couldn't play quarterback in the NFL? So by the time you pare it down, there just might not be many. And Tua will be. I mean, he absolutely will be an NFL quarterback. I think there was a little bit of premature hype about him being, you know, the surefire number one pick next year. He still has some issues that he has to iron out as a prospect. But it's pretty exciting to see he and Jake Fromm head into next year, and maybe Justin Herbert too, and say that maybe that 2020 quarterback class could be pretty good.
So, Matt, I'm reading this thing on Sports Illustrated that was a mix between what if Nick Saban went to the NFL and just a love letter to Nick Saban. So, you know, it's back and forth on a thing. But if he wins a national title with Tua, he will have the most national titles in college football history as a head coach. I guess you could say he slayed the dragon. He's at the top of the mountain. That happens. Are there coaches other than Saban, and how does Saban fit for you back in the NFL? What college coaches fit best in today's modern NFL?
Well, I think Lincoln Riley is the one that would fit best in the modern NFL. You know, everybody's in love with Sean McVay, and to some extent, Kyle Shanahan and Matt Nagy, and trying to go more towards an innovative, young offensive mind. I think Lincoln Riley definitely fits that bill. With Nick Saban, like some of the things I worry about, he's 67 years old, which isn't, you know, it's not that old. My dad's a little bit older than that, but it's like, that's pretty old to take on starting over in the NFL. And I think one thing that's different between college, Saban has reached, like you said, the top of the mountain. Like him being Nick Saban and Alabama being Alabama recruits for itself. And he can go get any player basically in the country he wants, unless the kid was born in Auburn, Alabama or Baton Rouge. You can't do that in the NFL. And I think that's where the struggles that he had before came from, not even just the Drew Brees versus Dante Culpepper decision, but a lot of the decision-making that happened there where you have to turn over your roster and you can't do it by just being charming and flashing all your national championship rings and getting, you know, 5- and 4-star guys to come play for you at an alarming rate where it's like they're too deep is an All-American game. In the NFL, you can't do that, as you guys know. You know, you have to scout. You have to develop. And I don't know that that's his game. I think he's the greatest college football coach of all time. Let's just let him be that. And he tried his hand in the NFL, and it didn't work. And it's okay. Let's just let him be who he is. But I would look at Lincoln Riley. I look at Matt Campbell. I still think Chris Peterson at Washington would be great for the pro game, even though he doesn't have that. He's not the guy that you would be like, oh, this is a great offensive, you know, mind, or it's not a great, he's not doing anything defensively that just makes you think, oh my God, we have to hire him. But look at what he did at Boise, turned them into a national contender, beat Oklahoma, and now at Washington, where they're churning out pro level players at every position, and there's just the way the program is run. So Chris Peterson would be great. David Shaw would be great at Stanford. I don't know if he's ever going to leave there, but those are the guys that, and obviously Matt Campbell at Iowa State, who I'm a huge fan of, and I think we could see him get into the league this year. Those are the guys that jump out to me as if I were going to hire a college coach, that's probably where I would start.
You did not mention Pat Fitzgerald, despite some rumors that cropped up regarding his connection to the Packers.
I love Fitz. I do. You know, I could see that. Like, he's tough, and if they want to kind of go with the no-nonsense, you know, guy to come in. But he has his dream job, is what it sounds like, at Northwestern. So I don't know if there's a whole lot of, you know, hurry up for him to jump out of there and leave. And we're going to hear so many things about that Packers job, guys, because it's a new GM that nobody really has, like, a finger on the pulse of. And there's going to be some wild stories out there. It's going to be funny when, at the end of the day, they just hire Josh McDaniels. And there's going to be all this smoke about Pat Fitzgerald or, you know, Matt Campbell. Are they going to get Bruce Arians out of retirement? And they're just going to go hire, like, the most cookie-cutter hire they can make and just bring in Josh McDaniels.
I want to talk about Aaron Donald from a scouting perspective and a lesson learned perspective, perhaps, because if I remember, we talked about him as a Senior Bowl participant, that Aaron Donald was not a guy who was just sort of off the charts, but that scouts said, wow, we just wait, this guy's going to be one of the greatest three techniques that's ever lined up. It took time, and he flashed at the Senior Bowl. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is just my memory. I remember talking to, it was at you and talking to Matt Bowen about it, that, and they said, hey, you know what, this Aaron Donald could be something. What does it say? What lessons can be learned in general about football scouting for somebody like that who rises late, who is a much, much better pro than maybe it took time to realize?
You know, I think with Aaron Donald specifically, the lesson is that sometimes there are players that are so good that you have to ignore, you know, the measurables. And I guess you could say the same thing about Russell Wilson, but I think Aaron Donald's much better at his position. But the fact that he's 6'1", 285 pounds when he was coming out of Pitt, that was all anyone could talk about. I mean, no one talked about just how incredibly productive he was in college, and he was. I mean, he was great at Pitt. I mean, and that would be the argument fans would say, but, you know, this guy had he had like 28 and a half tackles for a loss his last year at Pitt, 11 sacks. How the hell is this guy not a first rounder? And the only thing you could say to that is, well, he's small. And so I think that's one thing, and Baker Mayfield might be the same way, where you look at everything is great, right? Oh, my God, he's great leader, he's athletic, he's tough, but he's 6 foot tall. So I think that's the thing where you have to sometimes know when to say, it's okay. Johnny Manziel is probably the other side of that, of, oh, he's really small, but he was also a horrible person, you know, off the field in terms of, you know, just being a responsible human being. So it's just knowing when it all matches up, where you can comfortably say, yeah, I'm cool with the fact that Aaron Donald's probably 6 foot, 6'1", 285, and know that might not traditionally fit. But when you have his speed, his hand usage, his instincts, and for being such a, like, quiet, nice guy off the field, he puts the pads on, and he is a mean SOB. And I think that's where you got to be like, oh, my God, he has all these great traits put together. Let's not worry about how big he is. And the Senior Bowl should have proven that for everyone. I looked up quickly. I had him ranked number 11 overall in that draft class, which is embarrassingly low. I mean, he should have been top five. And that was a good year with guys like Khalil Mack and Jadeveon Clowney. He should have been higher. Having him at 11 was probably purely because of seeing him dominate at the Senior Bowl against, you know, bigger pro style offensive linemen, and saying, okay, well, he still can't be stopped against these guys. And you have great athleticism. I remember his combine performance, even just being like, this dude ran like a 4.68 as a defensive tackle. That stuff doesn't happen. And so it really should have been, in hindsight, it's easy to say this, but it should have been so obvious just how good he was.
Matt, apropos of a conversation Dan and I were having a little earlier in the show, we are taking a straw poll throughout the day. Please name your favorite sports blunder of all time, your favorite sports blooper of all time.
Oh, my gosh. That's a tough one. Probably the Leon Lett trying to run the ball in and Don Beebe swatting it out of his hand.
Okay. All right.
So I might be dating myself a little bit, but no, that one's way that up one. There.
I remember staying up late and watching that ball
game. The reason it came up is that now that Mark Sanchez is thrust back into action, he was asked by a reporter about what it means to be associated with the butt fumble, and my contention is that the infamous butt fumble is the funniest. I think it is the best, most evergreen, almost perfect sports blooper. You know, it's not some grisly injury. It's not, you know, it's not the agony of defeat. It's not, it is just on the field of play.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a man running into his teammate's ass and fumbling the ball and falling quickly enough to look cartoonish.
Yeah, can I change mine? I realized I went football because that's my job. But my favorite of all time is Lucas Duda overthrowing home when Eric Hosmer ran in the World Series. That's my favorite. Like, if I could just, like, I remember watching that, and I'm very superstitious. So I was in my office at my old house upstairs, kids asleep. It's late. You know, this game's going forever. And I lost it. I mean, I'm, like, jumping up and down, screaming. My ex-wife runs upstairs like, what the hell are you doing? And I'm like, you don't even know. Like, you can't even understand what just happened. I was freaking out. So that's the one where definitely, like, the most memorable for me.
Done. You have been so registered as Lucas Duda overthrowing home, your favorite sports blooper of all time. Excellent. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, guys. Good talking to you.
That is Matt Miller at NFL Draft Scout. Brought to you by Art of Pizza on State Street. Stop in or carry out, thin pan or deep dish. Hot, fresh, ready-to-go pizza slices from Art of Pizza on State Street and Polk. Choose from up to 18 varieties of slices for delivery or pickup from Art of Pizza on State Street, 727 South State Street.
I didn't want to infect the jury selection by saying the Sanchez thing. You're setting him up
right after the fact, right?
Butt fumble. I thought that would be inappropriate to do, but bloopers, the way, you know, it's. We'll probably take a straw poll throughout the day of our guests to see where we land.
All right, that's cool. One of our guests is going to be Ian Rappaport. He just posted some interesting and a little scary information about Alex Smith. And
I had seen this percolating. He's got it now?
Yeah, Ian's got it now, and we'll talk to him about it.
Man.
But there's apparently a complication to the surgery to repair his broken leg, and it's scary stuff. We'll get the details in a moment on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Well, years ago, we talked to Tom Moore, then at Indianapolis, the offensive coordinator. You got a busted play here, and then Sanchez gets hit. The ball is loose, and it's alive.
I have never seen this before in my life. Watch this. Vince Wilfork is going to throw Brandon Moore back into his quarterback. He's going to fumble the football. This is what Reggie White used to do to people, forklift them and just lift them off the ground. Mark Sanchez not expecting it, and it was the backside of Brandon Moore that knocked the ball out.
Yeah, that wasn't an opponent. It was his teammate's arse.
He hit it hard, went straight down. You're right, it is the way he falls.
Yes.
It's like he's... like a plank tipping on a fulcrum, it's straight back.
It's something out of Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. It's just, and he's down. And the fact that after he's down, the ball just kind of is like, oh, here's the ball, and it ends up being a touchdown. Everything about it is just perfect. So here's what Ian Rappaport reports. He's going to join us in a couple minutes. Quarterback Alex Smith is battling an infection related to the surgery he had on his broken fibula and tibia, sources say. It is premature to say what this means for his playing future, but it is being handled with care and dealt with seriously by doctors. Doctors performed surgery on him right away that night to attempt to prevent infection, and now he's battling one. Washington's football team has just released this official statement.
Oh.
On behalf of Alex Smith, we appreciate all of the concerns and prayers over the injury he incurred on November 18th against the Houston Texans. Although this is a serious injury, Alex and his family remain strong. We would ask that everyone please honor the Smith family's request for privacy at this time.
Wow.
It's scary stuff. I remember the Bears went through this with Shane Matthews. When Shane Matthews had a relatively routine surgery that it was complicated by a staph infection.
Wow.
And he lost something like 27 pounds. They said could have died. And this is staph infections are no joke. And depending on the specific strain, there are some known as MRSA or methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus that have already gotten past the last line of defense of antibiotics. And that though it's not the surgery that kills you, it's the infection.
Hope for the best for Alex and his family. Obviously, I interviewed his dad once. He was a principal, is a principal at a Helix High School out in California, where Smith was the quarterback. His running back, I believe it was Smith's junior year, and it was Reggie Bush's senior year at Helix High School in California. Can you imagine that high school football team with Alex Smith and Reggie Bush coming at you both?
Only if they're both wearing David Haw's Letterman's jacket.
Resplendent.
Yes.
In glory of yesteryear.
Wow. That's
scary stuff.
Yeah, this is really not good. And staff infections have been an issue in some of the training facilities of NFL teams. The Browns went through it.
The
Buccaneers went through
it. The Buccaneers.
The Buccaneers that had their kicker suffered a staff infection.
I think Gerald McCoy got it as well.
His career, I think. I think the kicker never kicked again. Saw an email here that Theo Epstein is inviting reporters over to the Cubs offices today.
Wrigley at 1060?
Yeah, he's good before he leaves for the winter meetings. They're calling it an informal media availability around 2:30 today, where he's going to sit down. Maybe it's another opportunity to lay out some of what the plans are going to be at the winter meetings and or find out about how he feels about Addison Russell beyond the statement that he made.
I would imagine some of the conversation is going to be around Addison Russell. The writers that are the think tanks have put out Addison Russell pieces as it concerns Cheryl Ring, I think, wrote the latest one. I don't know if you've read Cheryl's latest on FanGraphs.
I saw it. I have yet to read it. Regarding what baseball owes its fans.
It's very good. It's an interesting angle on what players, what fans, and what the game kind of come together on, and what's fair, what's deserved, what the expectation should be going forward. I highly recommend you go read it. It's on FanGraphs. Cheryl Ring wrote it. But I would also imagine that some of the conversation that is going to happen as Theo just kind of pours drinks and loosens the tie at this open availability for, you know, sports writers everywhere, I guess, to come ask questions.
You think he's got one of those like big sort of inlaid wooden globes that opens up into a bar?
Yeah, I'm thinking full Mad Men.
Yeah.
You know, just an absolute straight out of the early 1960s.
The unlabeled decanters of various whiskeys.
With crystal tops that you have to kind of take off and place very delicately on the drink cart or on the, you know, the globe that you've opened.
And it's decanters, by the way.
Single. Single chuckle there. But he's going to get asked questions about Paul Goldschmidt going to the St. Louis.
How do you
Cardinals.
Respond?
They're better. I mean, they're a better team than they were, the Cardinals, but I this is them trying to keep pace in an NL Central that has quickly gotten incredibly competitive.
It's a great acquisition for them. It is. And it does indeed make Anthony Rizzo a distant third as far as if we're ranking first baseman within the division. And with those who really aren't familiar with how good Paul Goldschmidt is, these are his statistically similar batters through age 30. So in the history of baseball,
he'll be 31.
These are the ones. This is through age 30. This is the list of hitters from 10 being the least similar to 1 being the most similar that resemble his production. David Ortiz, Lance Berkman, Larry Walker, Carlos Delgado, Ted Klazuski, Fred McGriff, Derek Lee, Mo Vaughn, Adrian Gonzalez, and Jeff Bagwell.
Those are terrific names.
Yes.
So there's two questions as it relates to Paul Goldschmidt in my mind. And one is he the best first baseman in the NL Central? I think he is.
Yes.
I think he's better than Joey Votto.
Career value, Votto.
Votto's a Hall of Famer.
Current ability, Goldschmidt.
It's Paul Goldschmidt. He is worth 5.1 Fangraphs wins above replacement. Over the last 3 years, only Freddie Freeman at first base has been worth more. Joey Votto over the last three, worth 3.5. Goldschmidt holds a lead over Votto in slugging percentage, weighted on base average, in weighted runs created plus. And the Joey Votto lead is in on base percentage, 417 to 389 over the last three seasons. But really the question is what kind of profile can you count on Paul Goldschmidt having over the next handful of years if the Cardinals pursue an extension? If they're not willing to pursue an extension, or if that's a profile, right-handed first base, not all that athletic, but certainly more athletic than most first basemen for Goldie. If you're not willing to pursue an extension, How much does getting Paul Goldschmidt help you in terms of trying to sign Bryce Harper? Because that is something the Cardinals ought to be in on.
Yeah, if you're doing it, you might as well go whole hog.
Press
right?
the gas pedal, man. Brewers aren't getting any worse. That is a tough, tough division. And if the Reds,
I didn't even think about looking at Jesus Aguilar's numbers in
he's
here.
He's very good, but more one-dimensional on the side of first baseman. I mean, he's good.
Yeah.
But he's pretty one-dimensional, and he doesn't play defense at all.
It's first base. You don't have to.
Yeah, but Goldschmidt and Votto can. So does Rizzo, but Aguilar doesn't. I mean, he didn't bring a glove. He just brings a breadboard and straps it onto his hand with duct tape.
Yeah, last year he was an OPS plus a 135.
Who's that, Aguilar?
Aguilar.
Yeah, over his last three, he's pretty decent. I mean, it's a good number, but it's far and away not Goldschmidt, not Votto.
Yeah, slash line for Aguilar last year, 274, 352, 539.
Over the last three seasons, he's actually more worth more Fangraphs wins than Anthony Rizzo. Not by much, but by 0.2.
Well, then is Rizzo the fourth best first baseman in the division?
I probably still bet on Rizzo.
Okay. Ian Rappaport of NFL.com and NFL Network has all sorts of news for us, as he does every week. He's coming up next on Bernstein and McKnight, Sports Radio 670, The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670, The Score, and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station, Ian Rappaport.
Here's what we know right now.
Insider for the NFL Network.
Get out your notebook. More.
Breaking news across the National Football League.
This is something that has been going on through the wee hours of last night, really round-the-clock discussions.
The Rap Sheet and Friends podcast.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story, and I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Ian Rappaport with Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.
Ian Rappaport is on Twitter at Rap Sheet. He of the NFL Network and NFL.com, the Rap Sheet and Friends podcast, which this week features an old friend of ours, former Bears special teams coordinator and current Kansas City Chiefs special teams ace Dave Tobe. Always an interesting interview. Ian, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. What's happening?
Well, you tell us regarding Alex Smith and this information that has just come out recently. This is serious stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, any time you have a player who breaks, you know, he broke his leg, he broke two bones, the fibula and the tibia, it's serious. They had surgery right away that night when Alex Smith first got his injury. And that, you know, obviously leads us to know that it is something that they're very, very serious about. And, you know, the reason they had surgery so quickly was to ward off infection. And unfortunately, that is exactly what happened. And look, sometimes this does happen medically, but it's not good. Alex Smith is still in the hospital, still dealing with the kind of injuries and complications from those surgeries. And at this point, my understanding is it's too early to say what this means about his playing career. There have been other instances where players, high-profile players, have battled serious infection. Rob Gronkowski had one. Tom Brady had one. Both are fine. So we don't know what this means, but clearly this is serious.
This happened with the Cleveland Browns and the Buccaneers at their practice facilities, right, when there were MRSA outbreaks and players affected. And if I remember at the time, Ian, it was about the necrosis that's involved, depending on how aggressive the bacteria may be. If there is actual loss of tissue, is different than like a systemic infection where they're just trying to bring down fever and flush it out, right?
Yeah, I do not know that this is anything related to MRSA or any of the sort of systemic infections that some of the other places like the Bucs had. I mean, that, you know, MRSA is particularly bad because it's resistant to antibiotics. This, I have not heard that this is that. I mean, they are giving him antibiotics. They've had another procedure. I don't know that that anything like this is compared to what those teams were dealing sort of systemically.
Scary stuff. Ian, appreciate the update. I wonder, you know, we've got a pretty big one on the evening of Sunday with the Bears and the Rams coming up, and it's so big that I talk in prose and out of order in syntax, I guess. Has the national perception of this game and the statement that it may or may not be, has that cooled at all with the Bears' loss to the Giants, or is this still as anticipated as it was 2 weeks ago?
Well, I mean, I think the loss to the Giants was kind of a weird one because obviously it's bad and you don't want to lose. But I almost, not that anyone takes moral victories at all, but I feel like if there ever was one, this was one, because, you know, the Bears fought like crazy. They had an incredible comeback. They ended up losing, but, you know, so much kind of went right for them that I don't even think anything has cooled on the Bears at all, just because of how they played, even in the road loss. I would say this, the sort of excitement for this game is still real and legit. Personally, I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, after the Rams and Chiefs played and we had 100 and some points scored and all the yards rolled up, I said, wow, look at this. Here's the future of football. And we talked about it. Do you get the sense that there are some around the game that are looking at this one? It's like, you know, come on, defense. Let the Bears prove that a defense is actually allowed to do what it does now. It is actually capable. And there's a bit of a larger test here to say, can a defense still be a defense even against this?
I definitely agree with that. Now, I will say this. I love sort of the old school football stuff. Like, I really do believe when you get in, not December, but when you get in January, first of all, it's freezing. Second of all, the refs let everyone play a little more. I do think defense ends up trumping offense if everything were equal, which is why I think the Bears would be a horrendous team to face in the playoffs, obviously. But part of me does kind of wish that, yeah, like the defense would jump up and you know, they'd clamp down and you can't block them, and that makes offenses struggle, and everyone realizes, okay, like this still is about the basics. So just personally for me, I find myself in these situations kind of hoping that the defense stands up and, you know, is noticed and affects the game. Now, the only problem with this game is the Rams got a good defense too. And someone on the Bears is going to have to block Aaron Donald and Ndamukong Suh and, you know, Dante Fowler now and everyone. So if you're rooting for defense, that's fine. The problem is the Rams can ball also.
How do guys around the league tell you that they try and keep the football away from Aaron Donald, that they just try and avoid him completely or double team? Or what is the sense of how you slow down this year's defensive player of the year?
I will be honest. I've had several discussions about that, and I haven't had anyone come up with anything, one, that actually works.
Well, that's terrifying.
Two, that, yeah. I mean, he's like, and you guys see him in person on Sunday night, I assume. It's really incredible. I mean, you know, we watched him on TV, but it really is incredible. He is a great, great player. You can do some things. You can, you know, you can kind of run outside. You can, you know, exploit the screen game, and that's all fine. But the bottom line is, like, when you're trying to just regular run the ball, he makes it insanely difficult, and he sacks the quarterback like he's a edge rusher. So, I mean, you double him every play. And you sort of just cross your fingers, but I don't know actually something that, you know, anyone can do.
Help me untangle the NFL's response to the Kareem Hunt situations, plural. Sure. And understanding now that the Cleveland Police Department has an internal investigation going on, they released a statement trying to figure out how the NFL got a copy of the police report without an official records request. And then we're wondering, why did the NFL want to do it in back channels to try to sort of keep it secret? Did they see the tape? Did they not? Did they want to see the videotape? It's another case here with all that we've been through of what did they know and when did they know it and what did they want us to know about that?
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, I'm sure the Cleveland police would like to find out how the NFL got their report, but I don't really understand the issue, because all we as a public have talked about the last couple of days is, how did the NFL not know this? How did the NFL not know that? Well, now it's come out that they're actively seeking this police report and got their hands on it. Why is it now a thing where, like, well, how did they get it? Like, the point is they should be able to get it. So I guess from the Cleveland police standpoint, it makes sense. But if everyone is clamoring, why didn't the NFL see the video? They should also say, well, glad the NFL was being proactive and trying to find this stuff. As far as the actual video, let me take you through kind of step by step. So the incident happens. The Cleveland police come in and do their investigation. They take statements from everyone. At this point, because it's a misdemeanor, what they say is, all right, the detectives will investigate this if the victims press charges. The victims did not and have not pressed charges yet. So detectives were not sent in. The police did not see the video. Until TMZ released it, the police did not have a copy of it and did not see the video. The NFL requested it, one, in the spring, two, in June when they got the 911 calls and the body cam footage. They requested it in June. The police didn't have it and were not helpful. The hotel said it is not their policy to give it to anyone but law enforcement, and law enforcement didn't request it. So the NFL could not get it. They also tried to interview the victims who did not respond to several requests via several different ways of reaching the alleged victims. And then, you know, the TMZ thing comes out, and then all of a sudden everyone sees the video. But until then, the only people who had actually seen it were the hotel, who, of course, then sold it to TMZ.
I wonder what your expectations are for life after Mike McCarthy in Green Bay in the next 4 weeks, in the immediate term, specifically for Aaron Rodgers, and in the long term.
You know, I don't expect too much to change. I imagine if there was something salvageable with the season, that we would have seen it under McCarthy. I mean, everyone knew he was under fire. He knew he was under fire. I know he was surprised by the midseason firing, but in general, I think it was very clear that he was in some trouble. So, you know, maybe they'll simplify things a little bit. Maybe they'll try to get the ball out of Aaron's hand. But if you watch the game on Sunday, Rodgers did not look good. I mean, just physically, he wasn't throwing the ball well. I don't know what's going on, but he looks like a guy who doesn't trust his receivers and wasn't executing at all. Maybe a light bulb comes on and McCarthy leaves and he's great. But clearly, Rodgers' level of play needs to improve, honestly.
We have an official who is being sanctioned, who's under review by the league, in a sort of a strange story. Umpire Roy Ellison is on administrative leave after the Bills defensive end Jerry Hughes accused him, I think he called him a bitch or something like that. I want to say it was the exact language there.
You can say that on the radio?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. Whatever. If somebody comes in and yells at me, I'll just say it. You know, just quoting the official here.
Sure. Okay.
Is this incredibly uncommon? Is this the first time a player has said something about it? When you first heard this, did you ever heard anything like this before?
Yeah, actually we have, with the same official. Now, first of all, let me say, I don't know what happened, and the NFL is looking into it, and I hope we will find out. I don't know that officials are mic'd, and I don't believe that Jerry Hughes was mic'd, so we may not actually for real know. It might be based on interviews, but we'll know more when the investigation takes place. But this actually, if this is true, Ellison also was suspended for his altercation with Trent Williams in the 2013 or 14 season, where he used a derogatory word to describe him.
Huh. I did not know that. That's certainly
did I.
I'm surprised he held on to his job through that. So it's an interesting mitigating circumstance.
Yeah.
Always good stuff, Ian. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, guys.
Ian Rappaport, NFL Network, NFL.com, the Rap Sheet and Friends podcast, this week featuring Dave Tobe.
The Midday Midway is next. I have a number of tales for you. A couple of stories that you might not have seen. One of them, a brand new drug that's going through the seal population.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be weird. We're going to get real weird in the Midday Midway.
I have an incident at an Amazon warehouse involving a product that I didn't know existed. I have a dumb Canadian criminal, and I have some lobbying efforts from not Big Cat Williams, but Big Cat, as in like Big Pharma, Big Tobacco. There
big
is
a, pumas?
No, big.
Big tigers?
No, big feral cat.
All right, the Midday Midway. That's next. It'll get weird. Bernstein McKnight, 670 The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.